Hello, my name is Elena Shotland. I have the honor of serving as the chair of the American Thoracic Society Sleep and Respiratory Neurobiology Journal Club. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Tom Keens. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thank you.
So, my first question to you, or first questions, is I would love for you to tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? And where did you study?
Okay, so I'm a Southern Californian. I was born and raised in Southern California. For the first part of my childhood, Ventura, which is kind of at that time an idyllic coastal town. We could ride our bikes everywhere, go what we call body surfing in the summer. We called it riding the waves then, but we learned later it was body surfing. And then moved to San Pedro, which is the harbor of LA. I went to college at St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is a great books program. It's a bit unique. There are no majors. Everybody takes the same thing, which includes 2 years of ancient Greek, 2 years of French, 2 years, 4 years of math, 4 years of science, and seminar, which goes over like the great books. So we read Plato, Aristotle, on down to the present. I loved it. It's not for everybody, but I loved it, and I initially thought I wanted to be a theoretical astrophysicist when I got out of high school. And I realized that I was going to have to go to graduate school to do that. So I kind of viewed undergraduate as taking some time off to kind of round myself out. And St. John's forced me to do that because I couldn't retreat into an astronomy major or something like that. I was accepted to UCSD Medical School. I was in the first class there. And that's really where I got exposed to pulmonary because I'm a pediatric pulmonologist. My advisor ran the pulmonary lab. He was very charismatic and enthusiastic about pulmonary physiology, and that's kind of my thing. And so he infected me, if you will. I went off to Children's Hospital Los Angeles for pediatric residency. And at the beginning of that, there was not a pulmonary program there. So kind of humorous, I think. The rheumatologists, who were about the only ones doing pulmonary function tests, who had to have them done somewhere else, would bring them to me to interpret, which of course I had done in medical school a lot, so it was fun. And then I went to Toronto, and that was probably a life-changing event. So Charlie Bryan was my main mentor there, and he was interested in how sleep affected primarily preterm infants, but other groups as well. Elliot Philipson was at the Department of Physiology just down the street. Colin Sullivan was actually a fellow of Elliot's when I was a fellow of Charlie Bryan, so I got to know him there. So I came away from that with the idea that, sleep does affect breathing. And there's a lot that goes into that. I came back, I was hired back at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. And this was a new concept there. I mean, nobody had thought about that at all. And so we started doing sleep studies. Now, okay, sleep studies were in the pulmonary function lab, which meant there could be no other pulmonary function tests being done because we'd turn out all the lights. We had an 8-channel strip chart recorder, so we could, do abdominal motion and end-tidal CO2 and eventually oxygen saturation. And a few things like that. Pretty crude. But on the other hand, for getting what we wanted, we could see obstructions, we could see central apneas, we could see hypoventilation, hypoxia, et cetera. And so we started doing that for fun. And I have to tell you, with the fellows who I made interpret these with me, we did what we called the sleep study dance. That is, we had this roll of paper from the school strip chart recorder, and we unrolled it down the hall in front of my office. And we walked down it looking, at what was going on. So, so in roughly 1981, something like that, there was a conference, a 3-day conference put on by some private group on sleep. And I thought, I'm learning about sleep in the respiratory system, but I had to go and learn about that. And I got introduced to the APSS then, which was at that time, and they should have kept this name, the Association for the Psychophysiologic Study of Sleep. I love that. But and I met Ron Harper and Toko Hoppenrohrs. And both of them I actually became influential mentors for me. So the other thing that happened along the way was that when I got back to Children's on the faculty, we had a baby with congenital central hypoventilation syndrome. It took a while to make that diagnosis, but we did make the diagnosis. And so everybody looked at me and said, "Well, Tom, you studied with Charlie Bryan. You know, you must know about respiratory control. So he's your patient." So fine. So we did that. And then, then what happened? The snowball. I mean, then we start getting all the CCHS patients in Southern California were referred to us. And in the late 70s, and again, this sounds crazy now, but there was a device that came out on infant monitors that allowed you to record breathing overnight. Basically, I thought, oh, this is wonderful. We can really figure out what's going on with people. So we got very much involved in doing the two-channel mammograms, which we could do on babies in their homes or in the hospital. And at that time, people felt that SIDS might be related to apneas. And so we basically were involved in that sort of thing. I think very quickly we realized that mammograms did not predict what babies were going to do. Certainly didn't predict death, but didn't predict even if they had severe episodes at home. And interestingly, we could not get that published. And I think it was because it went so much against the grain of what people thought was politically correct at that time that it couldn't find a home. I'm a little disappointed in that, but we tried several journals and finally gave up. Things were clicking along and we did that. And then we really collected quite a large group of the CCHS patients. And so, of course, that's their breathing is integrally related to sleep. And so we started to do research on the physiology of those, looking at respiratory control and things like that. And I think that was something that kind of got us known in this area a little bit. We really were the first ones that did ventilatory responses, traditional ventilatory responses to hypoxia and hypercapnia when they were awake, and showed that this was not just a disorder during sleep. We looked at exercise and found out that body movement actually stimulates breathing, which there'd been some work in animals, but I don't know that it had been done in humans so much. And then after that, we actually did a study where we passively moved the legs of patients and showed we could improve their breathing. Actually, interestingly, it also improved breathing in normal subjects. Let's see what else. So we kind of went along, I think, in that area. And so my involvement in sleep, I think, has it rose out of my interest in how sleep affects breathing. But we started looking at other groups too. We myelomeningocele patients have a central chemo receptor defect. We discovered Prader-Willi. Interestingly, I was not interested in studying these, but one of my fellows had a sister with Prader-Willi and said, "Oh, we've got it. You've got to study it. You've got to study it." They fascinatingly seem to have an isolated peripheral chemo receptor defect, so they don't respond to hypoxia. So this is kind of interesting. So that's kind of where I guess we've been and what we've done, and how I got interested in sleep. Sally Ward was my fellow in the mid 80s, and I actually had her do a project looking at arousal, hypoxic arousal in infants potentially at risk for SIDS. These were babies that had apparent life-threatening events, now called Bruis, or siblings of SIDS victims, which we weren't sure at that time whether they had increased risk or not. And then subsequently did arousal to temperature changes and to sound. And so she kind of took off there, and she was hired in the division. And so she basically set up what was a more traditional and appropriate sleep lab than us doing it in the pulmonary reflexive lab. And so we've continued to work a lot together, included obstructive sleep apnea, obviously, and obese adolescents. But I guess my favorites are still the respiratory control sorts of things. I think that was kind of a unique contribution, perhaps, that we made.
Of which achievement or paper are you most proud?
Oh, heavens. I don't know if I can narrow it down to one. In the sleep area, I think, well, okay. Actually, let me go back to another fellow. So again, in the mid-80s, it was noted that infants with bronchopulmonary dysplasia had a very high death rate. And people thought that that was due to a SIDS-like event. Of course, nobody knows what SIDS is, but nevertheless. And so at that time, as pulmonologists, we would do a blood gas on a BPD patient to decide if they needed oxygen or not. Now, blood gas is by definition awake because once you stick them, they wake up. So one of my fellows, Mina Garg, and actually Sharon at the time, Kirzner, now Isanaka, basically we thought, well, I wonder if they're different during sleep. And so we actually did a study where we monitored BPD babies and found that even those with normal awake blood gases had the significant periods of time of desaturation during sleep. This was using pulse oximetry. So I think that was something that was a bit groundbreaking. That people thought, oh my gosh, we can't just assume that a daytime blood gas tells us everything about what's going on with these kids. So I'm actually pretty proud of that paper, even though it didn't involve a lot of sophisticated physiology type studies.
What would you say brings you the most joy professionally?
Oh, teaching, and our fellowship. I was the fellowship director for our program for, oh God, I don't know, 30 years, something like that. Quite a long time. And I loved working with the fellows. I have to say, as an aside, that I was on the faculty of a busy clinical service, and I had a fair amount of clinical responsibilities. And I think one of the reasons that I got the research done that I did was that I was kind of charismatic and enticed fellows to come work with me. Now they, in all fairness, they were first authors on all those papers because they did the work. But we would talk about the ideas and do them and so on. And I think I enjoyed that more than anything. It was doing the research, but also teaching the research. And I think I've gotten the most satisfaction out of that professionally.
How did you keep up your career momentum?
Oh boy. Well, it's pretty exciting. I mean, one thing about doing research is, and let me just back up to the fellows a second. A lot of fellows would come into pulmonary fellowship, and of course, they were required to do research by the American Board of Pediatrics. It was fun to watch when some of these would really get interested in the research project they were doing. Now, it was probably true that most of those did not go on to be researchers, but they did seem to enjoy it. So I think, there was some infectiousness about it. So I think how I sustained my career was I just love my job. And one thing about academic medicine that was enjoyable was no 2 days are the same. I mean, you see patients, and I love seeing patients. I love my clinic. You teach, so in addition to teaching in the research arena, you're teaching clinically, you're teaching the residents and rounds, fellows, etc., medical students. I enjoyed that very much. And then, of course, the research, that's kind of a snowball. I mean, it starts and you find things out, and it just gets more exciting as you go on. So I don't know. I guess it's largely because I enjoyed it.
Is there anything you would have done differently?
I don't think so. I did have some opportunities. One that was that took me a lot of time to think about. I went to Hospital for Sick Children for fellowship, and I went there to study with Charlie Bryan and Henry Levison, and I had no expectation of staying there. I'm going there to be trained, and so on. So I went there, I got hired back to Children's, and I'd been there as a resident or families in this area. So I knew that there was great potential for developing a pulmonary service, and actually bringing the idea that sleep was important at all, just wasn't on the radar of anybody here. I'd been here about 6 months, and one of my mentors, Henry Levison, came out as a visiting professor. Well, I knew him better than anyone else because I'd been his fellow. And so he kind of hung out with me a lot. So we're sitting in my office, and all of a sudden he gets up and closes the door, and he says, "Dr. Bryan." Now, he was always Charlie to us. If you were in trouble, it was Dr. Bryan. And I'm thinking, wait, I haven't even been there for 6 months. He said, "Charlie Bryan wants to know if you'd be interested in coming back to be on the faculty at Toronto." And I thought, oh my God, it's something that I'd never even considered. Now, Toronto was such a research mill. I mean, I was pretty successful at fellow, produced papers. Starting off new in a place without any, it takes a while. There's momentum to get things going. And I thought, long and hard about it, but I ultimately decided to stay. And I think part of it was I'd already kind of made the mental sort of switch from being in a research mill to starting a program. And so that was kind of it. I should say I'm not the first pulmonologist. Arnold Plasker was the one who actually started it, but we were combined the neonatal and pulmonary division at the time, so he really had to spend most of his time on the NICU. So I do think that I had a significant role in starting the pulmonary program at Children's in Los Angeles.
If you had not been involved in sleep medicine, what do you think you would have done instead?
Well, I would have continued doing pulmonary stuff, but I think that sleep has such a profound effect, and of course, we've just learned more and more and more about that. I guess I can't quite see that, but I would have done pulmonary. I love pulmonary physiology. I like exercise and some other things. I probably would have gone in that direction.
What would you say the biggest technological innovations or changes that you have seen over your career?
Well, okay, now my career goes back a ways. I would say pulse oximetry. We didn't have that when I was a fellow. We didn't have it for the first few years that I was a faculty member. And that just has revolutionized our ability to monitor oxygenation. I think that was probably the main thing. I have to tell you, can I tell you a funny quick story?
Yeah.
So Elliot Philipson had a prototype of the old Hewlett-Packard ear oximeter that had like seven wavelengths and so on. It was kind of this bulky, huge thing. And so I and Tony Mansell, who was a junior faculty member at SickKids in pulmonary with me, went up to see this. Now, Elliot was famous for doing his work, initial work on dogs, and they were Dalmatian dogs. So I sat there and I put the probe over the white part, I put it over the black part, I put it over in between, and it worked. It didn't make any difference. And I thought, oh, this is fantastic, So we said to Elliot, "Can we take this down to SickKids?" Now, knowing what I know now, I could not imagine that if I'd gone to the LA Zoo, for example, and wanted to bring back some piece of equipment they've used on animals into the hospital, that I'd get further than the guard at the, but no, we brought it back. And so Tony said, "I've got a patient with pulmonary," he was on service time, "I got to set my patient with pulmonary hypertension on the chest ward. So let's bring her down and exercise her and see what happens." Not a good idea, but nevertheless. So we did, we had the pulse oximeter and we put it on, and it was a little bicycle ergometer. So she was sitting here, I was standing right next to her. Tony was over here, and the pulse oximeter was over here. So to look at the pulse oximeter, I couldn't look at her. All right. So we said, okay, start pedaling. And we didn't have it set at a high thing, but pulmonary hypertension patients, they're not supposed to exercise, right? So we said, keep going, keep going, keep going, and nothing's changing. So, all of a sudden, I feel her slump over against against
Wow.
my shoulder. And I turned around and she was quite blue. And then I look back and the pulse ox goes. So we found that it worked, but I did not take Tony's advice again about doing innovative experiments on patients. But then, obviously the traditional pulse oximeter didn't come out till many years later, but when it did, I think that was probably a huge advance that across the board in sleep and in other things. I'm not a traditional, as Charlie Bryan would say, sleep jock. I'm really a pulmonologist, and I've got into sleep because how it affects respiration, not so much, because I wanted to do all things sleep, like narcolepsy and stuff like that.
In retrospect, what has surprised you the most over the course of your career?
Probably that someone like you would want to interview someone like me. I don't. That's a good
Great.
question. What has surprised me? In the area of sleep, I'm not sure that I'm surprised, but I think there's just been this progressive advance of technology in terms of being able to diagnose things and so on. And it really started from the beginning. I mean, I told you what our initial sleep studies were like. To PSGs, to computer modeling of things like loop gain and respiratory control and stuff like that. Which, frankly, when I was younger, I wouldn't have imagined that that was a possibility even. We didn't have laptop computers until, let's see, when did I get, I got one in the division. There were going to be four. And I was doing pulmonary function testing. I said, I need a computer. And my boss said, no, you're going to share it with like five other people. Okay, fine. So I'm sitting in my office and our main administrative assistant knocks on my door and smiles and said, here's your computer. So I guess he changed his mind. So I remember I cleared things off my desk and said, put it right here. This is great. But of course, those things were very not very powerful or interesting compared to what's available now. I think, yeah, that's probably the area.
What would you say are the biggest challenges for the field now?
I think one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest challenge to advancement in academic medicine in general, but sleep and pulmonary as well, is the focus on RVUs and people having to generate their funds by, clinically. Children's came to this late in the game, but Children's LA, but we're now, if you don't have research funding, you're expected to be pretty much full-time clinical. And of course, you can't get research grants if you don't do research, and you can't do research if you don't have time to do it. And I think that's a major problem. I see in our hospital, the vast majority of faculty now are on the so-called clinical track, or even the clinical educator track. Very few tenured faculty. I was the only tenured faculty member in our division, actually. But fortunately, I came in before this got as bad as I think it is now. I think that's a problem, and I think that a lot of advances aren't being made that perhaps could be made. And I think there is a crucial role for the physician scientists. This should not just be 80% NIH-funded people, in their laboratories, but physicians confront the clinical problems, the things that are important and what the risks are. And I think they also have the tools, or at least can collaborate with others, to find the tools to answer these questions. So I view this as a real problem. I don't know if it's equally bad everywhere, but it seems to me it's getting worse pretty much across the country.
What advice would you give people new to the field of sleep medicine?
So, first of all, I think it's great. You got to love it. It's exciting. I think if somebody is so inclined to do research that they need to fight hard to get some research done. If they're a new faculty member coming in, there usually is a honeymoon period where they can have some time to be able to devote to scholarly pursuits or academic pursuits. I think that would be an important consideration. Now, some people may not want to do that, and that's fine. But I think incorporating teaching is very exciting and keeps you fresh. I mean, I learn as much from my fellows as I taught them, I think, if not more. So I would say don't just be a clinician out there, but be a teacher and a researcher if that's what fits your kind of view of yourself.
Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you would like to tell us?
Not really. No, this is great. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I want to thank you, Tom Keynes, for joining us today. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, thank you.